Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Foreign exchange rates aren't often mentioned in the same sentence as earthquakes, but the yen and the disaster in Japan are sharing a lot of headlines today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at progressive.com. Marketplace's Asia coverage is supported in part by the Star Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 18th of March. Glad to have you with us. It's a rare thing for an international meeting of finance ministers to agree on anything and to agree quickly. So the decision last night by the G7 countries to step in and try to control a rapidly appreciating Japanese yen is an indicator of how serious they thought the problem was. The yen spiked to levels not seen since World War II earlier this week, mostly a panic reaction by currency traders, but a potentially real threat to the Japanese economy as it tries to recover. As we continue our coverage of the disaster and its economic after effects, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has a look at how and whether a cheaper yen might help.
Even as Japan's stock market lost nearly a fifth of its value earlier this week, the Japanese yen got stronger and stronger, hitting an all-time high against the U.S. dollar. That's because investors expected Japanese companies, like insurers and citizens, to begin pulling money in from overseas to help deal with the quake. Ishwar Prasad is a currency expert and economist at Cornell.
So essentially right now there is a demand for more yen. And when the demand for yen increases, the price of yen rises.
A strong yen might sound good, but it makes Japanese products more expensive overseas. Toyota estimates that for every yen the currency rises against the dollar, the company loses 30 billion yen in earnings. So the G7 countries stepped in with a plan to sell off yen, pushing it down against the dollar and the euro.
What the G7 said was, we can't fix your nuclear reactors, but at least we can make sure you don't get whipsawed in the exchange market.
Marcus Noland is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says an expensive yen hurts everyone, from car makers to cell phone and laptop companies that rely on Japan for parts.
It could wreak havoc with the Japanese economy and then spread to other economies in Asia and then further around the world.
And keeping markets calm and international trade flowing is especially critical right now, says Cornell's Ishwar Prasad.
And trade is the one thing that's helped the global economic recovery.
Prasad says it's important to do whatever's necessary to prevent the world's third largest economy from slipping into recession. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Doesn't really matter how much Japanese components cost or what currency you use to pay for them if they're not available. And that takes us down to Shreveport, Louisiana, where General Motors has decided to close a pickup truck plant for at least the next week because it can't get parts from its Japanese suppliers. Honda, meanwhile, says it's not going to start making cars in Japan again until at least next Wednesday. So it's telling dealers here it's not going to be filling any orders until further notice. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports on the spreading industrial ripples of the earthquake.
GM is going to send parts that would have been used in Louisiana to plants where they're more needed. Final assembly plants like these, where the vehicles actually roll off the lines, are at the very end of a long supply chain. And what's happening in Japan is starting to disrupt it. Kim Korth runs a consulting firm that works with auto parts makers. Most of her clients are in the middle of that chain.
These companies are starting to get notifications from their suppliers that, you know, we're going to be unable to ship to you for the next 3 to 4 weeks.
So the people who make components like a steering mechanism don't have the parts to do their part.
When that starts happening, suppliers say, excuse me, I can't ship to this assembly plant. And pretty soon the assembly plant can't assemble the vehicle because it doesn't have enough parts.
The car makers want to avoid having to shut down. Todd Nissen is a spokesman for Ford, which so far hasn't stopped production. He says it's evaluating options almost by the hour.
You can look to see if that supplier can get, you know, needed parts from a different facility. Is there capacity that an outside supplier might be able to shift?
And the corporate scramble isn't just happening in the U.S. and Japan. Renault, the French carmaker, is cutting back production at a plant in South Korea. And GM's Opel has scheduled 2 work stoppages next week at a facility in Spain. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was an up but nervous session. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond this week will be mostly beyond, given the news of the past 8 days or so. Lizzie O'Leary is with us from Bloomberg News in Washington. John Carney is here from CNBC. Lizzie, John, good to talk to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So, Lizzie, I want to start, obviously, with Japan. And here's the thing that's been on my mind. You know, for the last, 2 years in this economy, we've been saying, oh, no, we're going to become another Japan. We're going to have stagflation. We're never going to get our jobs back. And it's going to be a lost decade like the Japanese have had. And now, in the past week, it's been supply chain interruptions, semiconductors, cars. Everybody's saying, oh, my gosh, what are we going to do without Japan and its economy? Make up our minds for us, will you?
And then you add to that yentervention or
interyention,
whatever we're calling it. You know, the idea that all the central banks didn't like seeing the yen soar because that was making things even worse or had the potential to make things even worse. And look, I don't think Americans have made up their mind. You are already hearing people, because I'm in D.C., they still keep that Japan debt to GDP ratio floating around in the back of the conversation.
Yeah. Elaborate on that for a little bit and make it make sense to us.
Yeah, we're talking about 200% here. Look, the idea that the U.S. could be looking at that kind of a debt burden and that it could be a very big drag on growth. So you are hearing politicians remind one another that fiscally, Japan is not in that great shape.
John, you worried about Japan and us becoming another one, given the events of the last week and us now missing Japan?
I do think that there was a little bit of an overplay about how bad economically things were in Japan. And in some ways, we are worse off. They had a slow-growing economy, but they had a lot of employment. Things were going steadily, if very slowly, in Japan. They might not have been growing at the rate they did in the past, but they didn't have the kind of permanent unemployed class that we seem to be developing in the United States. And that's the real problem. So, you know, in some ways, we may look back and say, you know, maybe if we became Japan, it wouldn't have been that bad.
Yeah, I guess politicians are fixating on that debt thing, not the other number that John's talking about.
Well, Lizzie, pick up on that yentervention thing. We talked a little bit up at the top of the broadcast. Stacey Smith laid out the news for us. But is what the G7's doing on the yen going to be enough to really help Japan out?
Well, it is if this stimulates exports, but obviously there are going to be a lot of things that are external to the value of the yen that make that happen. I mean, we're seeing a GM plant in Louisiana, right, northern Louisiana, essentially go idle for a while because they can't get the parts they need from Japan. There are other supply chain issues in electronics, in cars. So the value of the yen is important, but moving actual stuff is just as, if not more, important.
So, John, spitball this for me. In 6 months, where are we? I mean, Japan has come to grips with its economic slowdown. What about the rest of us?
I think there will be major profit losses at a lot of high-tech U.S. companies that have problems with their supply chain. There's a lot of talk of, oh, we can just substitute, you know, suppliers in South Korea or in China. But with some of the really high-tech stuff, it's very hard to do supply chain substitution. And people really weren't prepared for Japan to basically shut down.
John, one last thing before we go. The bank stress test results that the Fed released today, basically they said they're healthy, right?
They said that some of them are healthy and some of them aren't. They're not releasing the results, but we see them automatically by the banks that are coming out and saying, hey, you know, we could pay a dividend. We're raising our dividend. Now everybody's going to look at the banks that aren't raising the dividend or aren't paying a dividend at all and saying, you know, what's wrong with you? Why won't the government do it?
Well, on the topic of what's wrong with you, Lizzie O'Leary, what about the Federal Reserve? Now that the banks are healthy, can the Fed start raising interest rates again?
I don't think you're going to see them do that anytime soon because they've been super careful with their language.
Yeah.
You know, they're watching this stuff. And every time they put out a statement, the translation is, we're still waiting. We just still need to see a little more data.
Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg in Washington. John Carney at CNBC in New York. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last we heard from our correspondent in Japan, Rob Schmitz. He'd taken a wayward taxi ride into Sendai at the heart of the earthquake zone. Today, Rob brings us the story of that taxi company, family-owned and destroyed by the tsunami.
When I get into his taxi, Ryuko Yamano flashes a big smile. At first, I think it's because of the rather interesting name of his company, Smile Smile Taxi. But I quickly realized this short 63-year-old smiles all the time. He smiles while he's making a turn signal, when he's shifting gears, and even as he's barreling down the wrong way of a one-way street into oncoming traffic.
Slow down.
Yamano keeps on smiling as he slams on the brakes and swerves the car onto the shoulder. A car accident is the furthest thing from his mind. We're driving to Sendai, where he's lost friends, coworkers, and business. And a nervous smile is all he's got left.
I'm not sure Sendai's economy will recover. I'm worried that from now on, I'm not going to have enough money. I'll have to cut what my family spends on food, I guess.
As we approach Sendai, we listen to the radio. The host reads a list of homeless shelters that still have room. We drive by grocery stores with lines a mile long. Yamano takes us to Smile Smile Taxi's headquarters. There's not much to smile about. Two drivers are missing, and a third of the company's taxis are damaged beyond recognition from the tsunami. But anyone who came here today to sit around and mope is going to have a problem with Emi Sato. She navigates a cell phone call while barking orders at her drivers. She's the only woman at Smile Smile Taxi, and it's clear she calls the shots.
I think some people have given up on everything, but we've got to keep going. We've got to keep looking ahead.
Sato was in her first floor office when the tsunami crashed into the building, forcing her underwater. She swam to the stairway and crawled upstairs. She and her staff spent the night on the second floor asking for help via Twitter. Outside, the company's gas tanks exploded one by one over a sea of debris. Despite the state of things, Sato's already managed to snag a permit for a new gas tank so that business can begin again. Sato's father is known here as Boss Sato. He owns Smile Smile Taxi. He encourages his workers to eat some lunch. On the menu today, noodles boiled over an open fire pit with lumber scavenged from the tsunami debris.
The instant noodle warehouse around the corner was hit hard by the tsunami. All the goods were washed over here. My crew picked hundreds of packages out of the water, and that's what we've been living on for days.
The sake factory next door was also hit. The crew at Smile Smile has neatly arranged a few hundred bottles of castaway sake outside their office. By the looks of it, they've already tapped into the stash. It's a festive mood for a family business that's suffered so much loss. Boss Sato estimates there's around $10 million worth of damage. I ask him if he can count on the government to help him.
So far, there's no help at all. I lost everything. All I've got left is my guys, and there's nothing more I'd ask for. All the guys are dealing with losses at home and missing relatives, but they decided to come to work and rebuild this business. I'm so thankful for that.
Boss Sato is crying. He lets the tears roll down his face without wiping them. He doesn't want his guys to notice. But the guys around the fire see what's happening, and they quiet down out of respect. But after a minute, one of them cracks another joke, and everyone, including Boss Sato, starts laughing again. There's a lot of work ahead, but the guys at Smile Smile Taxi are ready for it. Reporting from Sendai, Japan, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up, locals in Austin, Texas are finding spare change in their couch cushions by renting them out.
This is where my dog sleeps on this couch, so I want to try to remove the dog smell as much as possible.
Oh yeah, I'll take that place. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 83 points on this Friday, 0.75%, closed at 11,858. The NASDAQ up 7 points, 0.25%, finished at 2643. The S&P 500 climbed 5 points, almost 0.5%, ended things at 1279. For the week, though, the Dow was down 1.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 2.6%. The S&P 500 down 1.9%. The Federal Reserve, as Carney was telling us, completed its latest rounds of financial stress tests, and the country's biggest banks all passed, which means some will start boosting dividends to shareholders. And so JPMorgan Chase deposited a 2.6% gain. U.S. Bancorp, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo each put on more than 1%. Bank of America, B of A, rose 0.4% today. Speaking of dividends, Cisco Systems is going to offer its first ever cash dividend. The network equipment company increased 0.8% today. Nike had hit analyst profit expectations every single quarter since 2006, but just couldn't do it this time. Nike dropped 9% after announcing it's going to raise prices on most shoes and apparel. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. By Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for February. The Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee holds a discussion. What role will world governments have over internet domain functions? And the United Nations observes the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. King Abdullah made a rare appearance on Saudi Arabian television today. He promised new jobs and higher pay in all $93 billion worth of economic handouts. It's the second time in a month the Saudi government has offered what is, in essence, cash in return for political calm. And it's mostly working within the kingdom. But earlier this week, Saudi troops were sent into Bahrain to help shut down the protests there. It was a political move loaded with religious and economic undertones because most of the protesters in Bahrain are Shiites, while the ruling family there and in Saudi Arabia are Sunnis. Gregory Gause teaches Middle East politics at the University of Vermont. He joins us now as we continue our coverage of that region. It's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
As we've been seeing on these protests in Bahrain, there's a distinct political element. There is now a military element with Saudi troops involved. I was hoping, though, that you could explain a little bit of the economic element, specifically the split between Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims in that country.
Well, the Shia Muslims are a majority of the citizen population, but they certainly haven't shared in the wealth of Bahrain. The Shia complain that they have a hard time getting jobs, certainly in the government. And they also complain that in the private sector, many of these jobs go to foreign workers. Obviously, it's the demonstration effect of popular protests in other parts of the Arab world that coalesced this movement in Bahrain. But there are these longstanding both political and economic grievances that underlie the mobilization of people into the streets.
The differences between these two groups, the Shias and the Sunnis, go back centuries. But as you look at the broader context of the Middle East, can you say that when Sunnis are in power, the Shias suffer economically, and where Shias are in power, the Sunnis suffer economically?
I think that this polarization on sectarian grounds is much more recent. Back in the 50s, the opposition in Bahrain to the government was across sects. It was Sunni and Shia. It was Arab nationalist. In the last three decades, the Iranian Revolution, events in Iraq, sectarian issues have come more to the fore. But it's not inevitable, and there are certainly many Sunni Bahrainis who share the desire for political reform.
Interesting. You say there are Sunni Bahrainis who share the desire for political reform. Are there Shia Bahrainis who are not in political power who share the economic benefits of Bahrain's prosperity?
Certainly. There are some rich Shia in Bahrain, just as there are some rich Shia in countries in the Gulf where they're a minority, as in Kuwait.
Do the Shia in Bahrain have access to economic opportunity? I mean, can they get educations and go out and find jobs that would contribute to upward mobility, or is it completely shut down?
Now, the Shia in Bahrain certainly have educational opportunities. They have access to the universities. They have access to the state schools. It's not an issue of education. I think it's an issue of the proportion of foreign workers in the labor force. And that's something the government can do something about. If you cut down the number of foreign workers, you raise the chances of the Shia getting jobs. But of course, you also raise your labor costs. So the employers aren't necessarily in favor of that. But you need some kind of political grand bargain that will cut down foreign workers and compensate the local employers for the increased labor costs that they'll have to pay. And I think that actually, while the politics of making the changes necessary to increase the economic opportunities for Bahraini Shia are difficult, it's relatively simple to reduce the number of foreign workers in your country. You give out fewer visas and you don't renew visas when they expire.
What's the government's inclination to do that, though?
I think that before this unrest, it was obviously much lower. One hopes that after this unrest settles down, the government will do a complete overview of its policies in this area and make some changes.
Gregory Gause is a professor of political science. He teaches the politics of the Middle East at the University of Vermont. Professor Gause, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We begin this next item with a definition. Botnet is the word in question. It's a noun, sometimes capitalized. A network of computers infected by a program that sends unsolicited emails, attacks websites, and reaps all sorts of other digital mayhem is the definition. The Rostock botnet is the biggest one out there, capable of sending out 30 billion junk emails a day. Or it was capable, until Microsoft got its digital crime unit on the case. What's that? You say you didn't know Microsoft had a digital crime unit? Yeah, me neither. Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
You can think of a botnet as an army of zombie computers under the control of an evil spamming mastermind. Rostock was really a network of about 1 million PCs that had been infected with malware and then could be commanded to send out spam.
That's a great analogy, really, because a zombie doesn't have a mind of its own.
Richard Boscovich is a lawyer at Microsoft's Digital Crime Unit, which led the fight to take down this spam-spewing monster.
So the idea was we had to locate what the command and control center was, how it was being operated, and sever that connection.
Boscovich wanted to lop off the zombie's head, so he filed suit against the unnamed operators of Rostock and then started looking for allies. He found one at Pfizer.
Viagra probably is the number one spammed product out there.
Patrick Ford is the head of global security at Pfizer and a former FBI agent. Working with Microsoft, he made drug purchases based on Rostock spam.
The results of those buys were either counterfeit product, meaning it looked like Pfizer, or it was unapproved product that was made in India and shipped into the United States.
Microsoft used this evidence to win a federal court order this week, allowing it to seize more than half a dozen servers running Rostock's botnet army. But even though the monster's head has been chopped off, 1 million infected zombie computers are still out there waiting for their next command. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The South by Southwest Festival is in its 25th year this year, and by the time things wrap up on Sunday, about 200,000 people from around the world will have made their way to and through Austin, Texas, all of them at some point having needed a place to lay their heads. So renting out a spare room or even a couch has become sort of a springtime tradition and a booming business in the Texas capital. From KUT in Austin, Mose Bouchel reports.
This week in Austin, before there was this...
Thank you very much.
There was this.
This is where my dog sleeps, on this couch, so I want to try to remove the dog smell as much as possible.
Kenny Furr is getting his house ready for visitors, paying visitors.
Yeah, I've had a lot of guests, but this is the first time that I'm doing it for money.
It seems like half the city is making an extra buck off a visiting Brooklyn blogger or Norwegian music writer these days. But all over the country, short-term home rentals are a fast-growing industry. Of course, businesses are popping up to connect renters with property owners.
HomeAway was founded 6 years ago in Austin, Texas.
Carl Shepard is co-founder of HomeAway.com, which has over 500,000 short-term rentals in 170 countries. Just last week, the company filed for an initial stock offering for $230 million. And as this cottage industry goes mainstream, regulators are taking notice.
Now that people can see that this is a really large industry, there is a natural inclination on the part of every municipality I know of to want to profit from that.
A recent study found just in Austin, the city was missing out on hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in unpaid hotel taxes. Robert Heil is the Austin city planner looking into new regulations.
Other cities around the nation have responded in very different ways. Some actively encourage short-term residential rentals and vacation rental by owners. And then a few places simply do not allow residential leases of less than 30 days.
Another proposal? Building the taxes into websites like HomeAway. Back at his house, Kenny Furr says he'll be paying whatever gets decided.
I feel like this is maybe a once-a-year thing for me. So if the comptroller comes knocking on my door, then, you know, I'll gladly pay the taxes.
And if all goes well this year, he might be breaking out the wet vac for a new set of visitors next South by Southwest. From Austin, I'm Mose Bouchel for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. By Mini, with 37 miles per gallon and 3 years or 36,000 miles of boot to bonnet maintenance. MiniUSA.com/info. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the somewhat arcane art of stock picking completely jumps the shark. A blogger at the Huffington Post noticed something unusual the other day. Seems when the actress Anne Hathaway is in the news, shares of Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, go up. His theory is that computer trading programs pick up internet chatter about Hathaway the actress. They apply it to Hathaway the stock and spit out orders to buy. I'm more of a Gwyneth Paltrow guy myself, but there's probably no way to profit from that, is there? Anyway, on a Friday, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 83 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ edged up 7 points, about 0.25%. The S&P 500 climbed 5 points, almost 0.5%. Bad week, though. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, given the news from Japan, how best to anticipate the unimaginable?
How many people prepare for what almost appears to be a once-in-a-lifetime event? I mean, truly, truly the height of catastrophe.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back here on Monday. Have yourself a good weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.